K-Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to Global Stuff. This post-Christmas, in between Christmas and New Year's edition, actually happened to be around and in town, and glad to be able to do this live. And welcome back my guest. She was here on last February, and we planned to have her last month, but that didn't work out. So glad that my guest for today, Jennifer Lowenstein, could make the time to be with us and discuss what's happening, the developments that have happened in the Middle East that we have done very frequently on this show, especially in Israel and Gaza. And maybe we'll get to other parts of the region. But definitely there's a lot going on there that I think people need to know more about. My name's Jimmy Dirschlag. I guess I should let you know that. I do this show usually the fourth Friday of the month, and we've been doing this for decades and bringing people who are doing important work on a variety of topics that relate to all of us. And I was hoping in this spirit of, peace on earth, goodwill towards men, that there would be no wars worldwide at all. Now's the season. Everything should be over now. And peace world, somehow that didn't happen. I don't know why, but thanks for making the time, Jennifer. Jennifer Lowenstein is an American activist, freelance journalist. She's a former associate director of Middle Eastern Studies and senior lecturer of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Wisconsin, and very knowledgeable about the region. And as I was starting to say, and we'll get into that more, I'm sure, is that, the ceasefire happened in October, and ironically, 2 years after the October 7th, almost to the day of the Hamas actions that have caused, not in the, it's been going on for of course many, many years, but that escalated what's happening in that region. And I think people since that ceasefire really have fallen out. Not that it ever got the attention that it needed, but certainly it's kind of fallen out a little bit of the public awareness. And I want to get into that. But first, let's talk about your background a little bit, because over the course of your life, you've spent a lot of time in the region, both in Israel when you were a little younger, and also have been back to that region and have spent time in Lebanon. In fact, you were thinking you might be in Lebanon now. So talk about kind of the trajectory of your life and your involvement and knowledge of that area.
You know, it's not atypical among Jews who have become anti-Zionists. I grew up in a family that was pretty political as far as American politics were concerned. My parents were very much against the Vietnam War. They were very much in favor of the civil rights movement. They were very traditional leftist Democrats. Whenever Israel was brought up, they immediately were supportive. You know, they didn't really, I know now, they didn't really know that much about the Middle East or about Israel. But back then, it was just a knee-jerk reaction that was pro-Israel. And it took my going to Israel as a junior in college, and also, studying the subject on my own and in classes, that made me start to question everything that I had grown up believing. And I think that that's not an atypical story. I think there are a lot of Jews now who are finding themselves watching what's happening and being appalled. I tend to be a little bit further to the left of many of those people, in various ways. And that may be a result of having lived in the Gaza Strip, traveled extensively through the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. And also I lived in the Palestinian refugee camps of South Beirut, Lebanon. And, you know, I've been back and forth to Beirut, I don't know, maybe 10 times in the last 15 years. And when you go and you immerse yourself in other cultures and other lands, and especially ones that are supposedly our adversaries, you start to get a very different picture on the world. And for me, that definitely happened.
And you actually were first there when you're much younger, when your dad was in the orchestra there as a as a trombone player. I love that your dad was a trumpet player. No, yeah, I'm the trombone player.
Yeah,
he was a trumpet player. But
that's right. I mean, I was 3 years old, and my father was, he had been in the Pittsburgh Symphony. And then gotten out after he got married and had three kids. He wanted to be closer to home, but we were in Wichita, Kansas, of all places, and they weren't particularly happy there. So a friend of my father's offered him the job of first trumpet in the Israel Philharmonic. Now, that friend happened to be Leonard Bernstein, so it mattered quite a bit.
Yeah.
As a result, we moved to Israel. Now, I think the funniest part of that whole story is that my parents absolutely hated it there, and it had nothing to do with politics. They were used to the comforts of America, and in 1963, Israel was, you know, what can I say, a third world country. I remember as a three-year-old seeing just mounds of sand and dunes being plowed up. I mean, now I look upon all of that in a different way because I see Israel as a settler colonial society and one that I very much oppose. But what I'm saying is that my parents didn't stay or not stay because of any Zionist or anti-Zionist convictions. They had three kids and they were trying to get on with their lives and they just didn't like the standard of living. So they came back.
I'm sure when you look at pictures of contemporary Israel, like Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and other places where you were, it probably looks a lot different to you.
Oh, dramatically, dramatically different. I mean, it's a whole different country. I see Israel today as, you know, people want to say the 51st state. I would, you know, I think it's more than that.
I thought it was Canada or Greenland, but anyway.
but I mean, literally the amount of money that the United States pours into Israel every year is just staggering. And with the war on Gaza, the total amount was somewhere between $38, $40 billion, which is just outrageous. But the point that I was going to make is that Israel, it's, you know, the lives of the individual citizens in Israel are being subsidized by the United States. They have national health care because, you know, we're subsidizing it. We can't get it for our own countrymen here, but that's a different story.
Let's talk about since the, in quotes, you know, you can see my air quotes for ceasefire since October 10th, this whole concept of the yellow line and what that means and how that's being implemented and some of the things that are going on right now. Because really, the conflict is not ended.
Well, in the words of a number of friends of mine in Gaza, and they all agree on this 100%, there's no ceasefire. There is no ceasefire. Bombings continue. Demolitions continue. IDF incursions continue.
The Israeli Defense Forces,
I should say. Yeah. Yes, which is, you know, misnamed because it's hardly a defense force. There's not enough food. Medical supplies are not getting in the quantity that is needed. People in desperate need of medical care are not being allowed out. And all 36 of Gaza's hospitals have been bombed and partially or completely destroyed. So the way that people are living in Gaza right now is exactly the same as it was prior to the so-called ceasefire, with one small exception. And maybe it's not so small. the intensity of the bombing has relented a bit. The constant bombing is not happening, but everything else is. And as you alluded to, basically with the 20-point plan that Trump bragged about as having brought peace to the Middle East for the first time in 3,000 years, hyperbole, anyone? The yellow line was supposed to be the first line that the Israeli military was going to withdraw to. And then with the progress of this agreement, they were supposed to completely withdraw from Gaza. Well, of course, that hasn't happened. And a lot of people could have told you it wasn't going to happen before the ceasefire was even signed. And again, I apologize for even calling it a ceasefire because it isn't. The yellow line has now become and looks like it's going to be a permanent partition of the Gaza Strip. And everything besides the fact that the yellow line is encroaching almost daily on more of a Gazan territory. In other words, it's there, but there are parts of that yellow line that are moving towards the west, which means they're expanding it slowly. We're seeing military installations, guard towers, roads being built in this area of land behind the yellow line that suggests one thing. It suggests that Israel has absolutely no intention of leaving, that they're planning to be permanent. There's already talk by some people about resettling the north of Gaza because, of course, the towns of Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia no longer exist because, you know, we flattened them into a moonscape. And when I say we, I deliberately mean the United States and Israel, because I don't see this as an Israeli war that the United States supported. I see it as an Israeli-American war that we are in together. And meanwhile, the yellow line, everything east of the yellow line is going to be, I believe, annexed to Israel in the long run. That's my view. It's called the Green Zone. And everything to the west of the yellow line, which is about 45-44% of the old Gaza Strip, that's where 2 million people are living in utter squalor, in tents in the rainy season when it's cold and windy and there's flooding to the point where, you know, children are practically sleeping in water. I mean, it's the circumstances are really difficult to describe.
I want you to get into that more, but I do want to remind the listeners that this is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
My guest is Jennifer Lowenstein, who's very knowledgeable about what's going on in Gaza right now in that region. She is an activist, freelance journalist, former associate director of Middle Eastern Studies and senior lecturer Middle Eastern History at the University of Wisconsin. We're talking about what's going on, which Jennifer has, of course, rightly said there really is no ceasefire, even though we think there is. And talking about the yellow line, this is, as you said, it's more than half of Gaza to the east of. So really, it's almost like a moving barrier that they keep pushing people into a smaller and smaller space. I saw it described as a smaller cage.
That's interesting. I was just going to say that Mohammed Shahada in the online magazine, The New Arab, he just recently wrote an article called A Smaller Cage. And he shows what's going to happen to the so-called green zone and red zone of Gaza. The green zone, of course, where Israel, of course, I don't think they're ever going to give it up. But in the meantime, they're hoping to construct some temporary housing there and house people who don't want to live in the red zone there. But those temporary structures and homes are more, they're going to look much more like detention camps.
Right.
of the worst kind. You know, they're not nice, comfortable places that are cool in the summer and hot in the winter. They're like tin cans, so that you're freezing in the winter and you're boiling in the summer, and they're not going to be permanent. With, I believe the ultimate goal is to expel those people.
As they've said, as they frequently said, Netanyahu and everyone else, even Trump has said they want to change the whole, get them out of there and rebuild the whole place to a luxury.
it's a nightmare. Actually, what I think most people don't know is that the Palestinians, the only Palestinians right now who are living in this green zone, which is behind the yellow line, I know we got a lot of colors here, are families of these hired tribes by Israel, these hired guns, if you will, part of the Abu Shabab gang, which is connected not only to ISIS and the Sinai Peninsula, but also to a lot of drug money and drug runs in Sinai and going into Gaza. These are the people who are being paid to cooperate with Israel, and they're the ones who are now living away from the red zone, which is where, you know, the old Gaza is, although it's in, you know, 44-45% of the old Gaza. I don't think it's possible for most people to really understand what it's like to live in essentially a beach landscape, sand, lots of sand, by the Mediterranean Sea, 2 million people with destroyed homes all around, destroyed buildings. There is no, you know, with the somewhat exception of Deir el-Balah in the middle of the Gaza Strip on the coast, it hasn't been totally destroyed. Everything else has been totally destroyed and continues to be destroyed because we're seeing airstrikes on a daily basis. The other important thing for people to understand is that one former city, because it was also destroyed, that really makes a difference in this division or partition of Gaza is Rafah.
Right.
Rafah is the city that is on the border with Egypt. So because it's behind the yellow line, Israel now controls all of Rafah. That means that for the Palestinians, they no longer have an outlet to the other world besides Israel. I mean, they can't get into Israel either, but there are crossings. Now, with Israeli control of the Rafah crossing and all of the old city of Rafah, Palestinians have no border with Egypt.
And I want to just say, talking about what's still going on, you know, there was an encounter punch on December 12th. There was a summary of some of the incidents, like it had 164 incidents of direct gunfire targeting civilians. Since then, already 265. So that's like a week or so ago. So every day these increase. 150 now, demolitions of homes, and that's, I'm sure, increased as well. The detention of civilians, they're saying that that time the death toll was officially at 70,000 and 171,000 injuries, but they're saying it actually the death toll is probably three times higher than that official 70,000 number. And you're talking, like you say, a population of 2 million, maybe a little more. And so what percentage is that? It's a huge percentage of the population. Where are people living? People are mainly in tents. You're saying it's like destroyed. Are they trying to live in the rubble of the homes that they've gone back to?
Some have actually moved into some of the buildings that were bombed, but partially standing. And there have been at least two cases now of those houses, which are completely unstable because they've already been bombed, collapsing on them in the rains and the heavy rains and wind. So, you know, already people have died trying to find alternative shelter to a tent. And the caravans or mobile homes, as we know them, that were supposed to be imported into the Gaza Strip along with weatherized tents, they're not there. They're not coming. Israel is not allowing them in. In the ceasefire agreement, Israel was supposed to allow in approximately 600 trucks of aid per day. In reality, between 100 and 150 trucks per day are what's getting in. And a lot of the goods that are coming in are not the goods that are the most badly needed. Sometimes it makes no sense what's getting in. Coffee, chocolates, things like Nutella. I mean, it's almost deliberate because these things are not nutritious. I mean, people in Gaza need fruit and vegetables and protein. Having Nutella snacks and stuff like that, you know, that's not going to help.
And at a quarter of the amount of trucks at best, and they're still swarming them every time they come in because they're so desperate.
That's right. I mean, I've seen mixed reports. One report recently, and I'm trying to remember who published it, says that Gaza is still on the brink of famine because not enough food is getting in. There are a lot of people who simply don't have the means or the ability to get to the places where there might be food or to afford it because the prices are sky high. So there's still a great deal of malnutrition, very much a chance of dying of it. But other reports are saying, okay, it's hunger, it's insecure, food insecurity. In other words, okay, we're not really now in a famine because some stuff is getting in, although it's not enough. But it's not the best kind of food you need. And the other thing that I think is important is that the medical supplies that are needed are not getting in. I read somewhere that it's about 5 trucks of the 100 to 150 per day that have medical supplies, and that 3 of those trucks are distributing basic supplies to some of the clinics that are set up around, mobile clinics that are set up around the strip, not in the hospitals. And the other 2 trucks are left to service with medical supplies 36 hospitals, or at least the ones that weren't completely destroyed. So I guess the point that I'm trying to make is, although that the official death toll is 70,000 and there are a suspected minimum of 10,000 people under the rubble, it is either much higher or it is going to get much higher. I think both, because we're not counting in that death toll the number of people who are dying of their wounds, who are dying of sickness because they can't get proper health care, who are dying as a result of malnutrition in some cases. It's a catastrophe. Listen to this. On October 6th, 2023, and all the days prior to it, the number of trucks getting into Gaza then was approximately 800. And that wasn't considered enough. So for the ceasefire agreement to say, okay, well, 600 per day is what we'll allow in, that's already insufficient. And the fact that 150 per day is what's getting in, it's pretty pathetic. And to me, that's no difference than, you know, there's no ceasefire.
And as you are stating, even with all of the continuing bombardments and military actions that are happening, a lot of what's affecting the population, illness and deaths, are what's intrinsic to the situation there. As you mentioned, all these hospitals have been bombed, so if they need medical care, they can't get it. I saw a very heart-wrenching article about these people living on the edge of these huge garbage piles in Gaza City. They're not taking the garbage away, and there's all of this, health hazard, mounds and mountains of garbage with people living in tents right alongside them.
And where else can they go? If they dare even approach the yellow line, they're shot on sight with the intention of killing. And since Gaza looks like a moonscape, although a moonscape is probably more appealing, there aren't any municipal services. There's no way of fixing the sewers that are broken. So there's open sewage running through these garbage tips as well. And where's the garbage going to go? Who's removing the rubble? You know, the last I heard, the one the one thing I thought was good that Trump said recently to Netanyahu is that Israel's going to have to foot the bill to remove the rubble because there aren't any other countries stepping up to do it. And of course, I don't blame them. In 2008 and 9, in 2012, in 2014, in 2021, Israel went into Gaza, bombed it relentlessly, destroyed millions of dollars of property. And each time, I believe Qatar or another wealthy Gulf state stepped in for the reconstruction. This time they're saying, we're not spending millions of dollars to fix a place you're going to destroy again overnight. So Trump actually said not too long ago that Israel needs to foot that bill. Well, you can imagine that didn't go over well with Netanyahu. And of course, nothing is happening at present. So I don't see it ever happening.
Well, he'll be talking to him on Monday, I hear. So we'll see if that topic comes up. Maybe he'll remind him.
Well, and as you said, if the topic comes up, it looks right now that the main topic of conversation between Netanyahu and Trump on Monday and through next week is going to be whether or not to go back to war with Iran, as Israel is pushing very hard for us to do. Trump wants to be a peacemaker and so far is saying no, even though he willingly joined the 12-day war on Iran last June. And we know from documents now that Trump and Netanyahu planned the whole thing. You know, they knew very well what they were doing when Trump had a diplomatic engagement planned with the Iranians. But of course, that never happened because the U.S. bombed Iran. But in any case, the main topic of conversation is allegedly going to be whether or not Israel can get a green light from the United States to go back to war with Iran. I sure hope that Trump holds his ground, but who knows? We've got people in the cabinet like Rubio and Hegseth. They're hawks. They'd love to see us go back to war with Iran.
And again, I remind the listener, this is Global Stuff. My name is Jimmy Derschlag. My guest, Jennifer Lowenstein, journalist and former associate director of Middle Eastern Studies and senior lecturer of Middle Eastern History at University of Wisconsin. She publishes often on Counterpunch, Common Dreams, and other articles. In fact, the article that originally we were going to have you on for this time, which I don't know if we'll get into it all, about if Hannah Arendt lived today, she'd name Israel's genocide in Gaza for what it is, radical evil. Hannah Arendt, very well known for her theory of the banality of evil, for which she got vilified when it was published until people realized what an important concept it was, and which is the concept that people can do these things, and I'm sure it's involved in Gaza as well, because it's like their daily lives. They process the documents, they stamp the documents, they give the authorities, they're just doing piece by piece and get involved in what ends up being horrific crimes. It happened with the Nazis and it's happening in Gaza now. But I did want to go, I know we've talked about the Yellow Line a lot. I think you just brought up something about the Yellow Line, which is what's the boundary that's been created, if people didn't hear the beginning of the show, that cuts out over 50% of Gaza and puts the people who have returned to Gaza on the other side, the green zone, which probably isn't totally green anyway.
No. The green zone is
the other side, the eastern side. Yeah.
And the red zone, Al-Mawasi, the beach area, that's about 45% of the old Gaza. That's where the vast majority of people are going to stay. That's where Hamas still exists. There's, some reporting that Israel wants Hamas not to be completely obliterated there, because as long as they can say Hamas is still active in the red zone, they can continue to bomb it and make the lives of people even more miserable than they already are. And I believe that is probably exactly what Netanyahu wants to do. And it's not just Netanyahu. It's the entire government, minus a few people, very few people. And unfortunately, it's also a very big chunk, majority of the Israeli population.
And I recently saw one of the journalists. They recently allowed a small group of journalists. Basically, journalists have been forbidden to go into Gaza. Mm-hmm. But it was a recently an escorted group of journalists to see this yellow line. And very interesting, Israeli journalist was aghast that she couldn't really tell where the yellow line was. They have these markers, but her response was, well, how are people supposed to know where they can and can't go if they don't know where the line is? And if they cross the line, they're getting shot.
No, if they approach the line, if they're seen not even in crossing the yellow line, they get shot and killed. And as I was saying before, the few markers that there are for the yellow line, some of them are moving, and they're moving westward. So they're basically taking more, Israel is taking more territory. And that's, you know, that's the story of Israel, basically, is stealing other people's land. And it's continuing. It's continuing now as we speak. It's really quite astounding what's happening, because it's happening in front of the world. In the meantime, Israel has not for 1 second given up its ultimate goal of either exterminating the population of Gaza altogether or expelling it. And interestingly, today, one of the news items that didn't really get much press, as far as I could tell, is that Israel has recognized a breakaway region of Somalia called Somaliland and made an alliance with it. Now, this is a very cynical move. It's not done because Israel thinks the people in Somaliland deserve self-determination or their own country. It's done because if you look at a map, Somaliland is directly across the Bab al-Mandab, the channel of water between the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean, that if you cross it from Somaliland, you land in Yemen. Israel wants to be able to surveil the Houthis and know what they're doing because, you know, make no mistake, Israel's not done with Yemen. It's definitely not done with Lebanon or Syria. And it looks very much like it could be heating up the front with Iran also. So, I mean, I don't know how much time will lapse before we see the next conflagration. It could be a year or more, it could be a week. But here's another example. Plans were drawn up by military planners, adopted and approved by the Knesset for the next attack on Lebanon. They've already been drawn up. They've already been approved. The only thing holding Israel back right now from an attack on Lebanon, an all-out attack because they want Hezbollah disarmed, is Trump. The Americans so far have said, no, not right now. We don't want another, you know, big war. Or in Lebanon, I suppose it's never that big, but it's very destructive. In fact, one thing that I think very few people are aware of, because those people who pay attention are rightly following the plight of the Palestinians in Gaza, whom Israel wants to ethnically cleanse completely. In the meantime, there is another ethnic cleansing program going on in southern Lebanon, where at least 350,000 Shia Muslims have been forced from their homes. Their homes have been destroyed. The land is being burnt and blackened to create a dead zone. And this is happening daily. Israel is bombing Lebanon daily and has been. Listen to this for a statistic. When there was a truce agreement or a ceasefire agreement signed between Israel and Lebanon on November 27th, 2024, it's now December 26th, 2025. Israel has violated that ceasefire over 10,000 times. And that's not my pulling a number out of a hat. It's actually calculated. And they've killed close to 400 people. So they're killing people every day. They're bombing Lebanon every day in the south. They're getting rid of the Shia population, which is their goal, because the Shia population is the part of the population most supportive of Hezbollah. And they're creating a dead zone. In other words, they're trying to create two things in the south, a strip of land that is literally useless, that nobody can, it's uninhabitable. That's the zone closest to the Israeli border. And behind that, they're destroying and demolishing all the homes, all the buildings, all the factories, everything, all in the name of blowing up Hezbollah weapons depots, right, and arms manufacturing. But they aren't providing any evidence that that's what they're really blowing up. So I maintain that what they're doing is destroying South Lebanon,
right,
for very cynical reasons.
Let me jump in here because we do have a caller. I haven't announced it, but I'm not surprised. It is, the number here is 707-923-3911. Not a lot of time in the show, but welcome. You have a question for Jennifer Lowenstein? You there? Hello.
Hello, Hello, yeah. Jennifer and Jimmy. Great show. I tell you, Lebanon is a revenue procurement for the military industrial complex. You can go back. It's all online. You can get it. It's this is just a same old story, brand new lies. But here's the thing. I think that because Israel thinks that they are entitled to the land many years ago that they cohabitated with the Palestinians, by the way, now they want it back. And the thing is that if the Native Americans in America here did the same thing, I know this is a mouthful for you, buddy. Everybody get a mouthful here. We don't want that. We're not going to try to do it here in America. But if Israel does this where they are, this is a problem. There should be a shared property of land. Help each other. Don't denigrate. You know, I'm a Hungarian Jew, and I have a conscience. I'm probably your worst nightmare. But this is the thing. I think we're going at it at the wrong direction. We should all be concerned about the children, all of our children. And K-Mud Radio, you got mud in your ears. Don't ever clean it out. And thank you for all this. I'm going to get off.
Thank you.
I feel like I'm pontificating. I apologize.
Well, that's okay. I appreciate your comment. I'm sure Jennifer has a response to that. And I think we could go on and on about the various two-state, single-state, whatever solutions. But I think your point about can they cohabitate, which is the way, as you say, historically it was before 1948. Do you have a comment on that, Jennifer?
Yeah, I didn't know. I didn't really find a question in there. But
no.
I think Israel has never cohabitated. Well, never is not the right word. As you said, even well before 1948, there were tensions between the Yishuv, or the Jewish community, in Israel and the Palestinian population. And most of that was because the Palestinian population didn't like their land being given away by the British to people who were essentially foreigners. And I think they were completely justified in having that opinion, because there were all these European foreigners pouring into their land that Great Britain managed to hand them on a platter without offering Palestinians any kind of self-determination. And so, you know, it's, I could go into a lengthy history lesson, but I don't think that's what we want here. I think the problem is that Israel is a settler colonial society. And as such, it's behaving as a settler colonial society. It's oppressing the indigenous people of Palestine, now going on at least eight decades, and really longer than that. And I don't think that this is going to stop until Israel is dismantled. And what I mean by that is I don't advocate destruction of anything. But I do advocate for Israel massive transformation of its governing structure and of its political system. It has to become a society where citizens are all equal under the law. It has to get rid of this Zionist ideology that makes Jews the only ones capable of redeeming the land or of having proper citizenship in Israel. You know, there's everything wrong with Israel's governing structure today. People call it a democracy. It's a democracy if you're a Jewish Israeli and you live there with a Jewish supremacist ideology that you grow up with. But it's not a democracy for the Palestinians, and it's not a democracy in the greater picture. As far as one state, two state, that kind of thing, I don't like to answer that question because I don't think it's my choice. I think the Palestinians should decide for themselves what kind of solution they believe is best. It shouldn't be imposed on them from without. And personally, just as a gut reaction as a human being, I wouldn't blame any Palestinian on the globe for not wanting to live next to a people that are in the process of exterminating it. I mean, there's a genocide going on, and now people are saying one state, two state. Excuse me, but we need to really do some transformation in Israeli society before anybody's going to want to live next to a population of people that is happy to watch their neighbors get exterminated.
Again, this is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. My guest, Jennifer Lowenstein, journalist, former associate director of Middle Eastern Studies, senior lecturer of Middle Eastern History at the University of Wisconsin, retired from that position, but still very active in a lot of different things, contributor to Counterpunch. You'll see her on Common Dreams. She's very, and I assume still involved with the Madison Rafa Sister City Project that brought a lot of attention years ago to that situation. We talked about the last time she was on the show, and actually I know there's a lot to talk about. I wanted to get into more about the concept of whether Israel will ever get out of there, and what I found interesting article about these anti-Hamas armed groups that Israel is supporting, as you brought up. There's several of them, but one of the things that really that you published that really affected me strongly when I read it were the letters from Rafa that you published. I guess the ones I saw went through April. I did want to ask you if you've had any more since then from your friend who was giving a very graphic description of what they were living under in Rafa. And you were just talking about Rafa as having been taken over by controlled by the Israelis.
It hasn't just been taken over. It's been literally wiped off the map. Rafa, as it existed, no longer exists. And the person that the person whose letters I had published, her name is Hudia. We write back and forth almost every day. So yes, I published that in April, but I've since received, you know, hundreds of messages, short and long, from her, detailing the way that they are living. And that's one way and one reason I speak with some authority, because I'm getting it straight from her. This isn't just someone I tapped on Facebook or somewhere else to write to because she lives in Gaza. This is a friend of mine who has been a friend of mine for 25 years. And, you know, she's got a big extended family, some living in Gaza, very few got out in time. One brother lives in Brussels. But in any case, I'm getting all angles of the story of Gaza and what it's meant for the population. And it's really difficult for me to even begin to describe it because it's so spirit-crushing to wake up in a tent day after day after day for 2 years on end. These people don't have homes left. Their homes were destroyed a year ago when Israel went into Rafah. So, and now they're all living on the beach in tents. And so I get messages from her saying, I don't want to live in a tent forever. This is, you know, you just wake up and you stare and you wonder, is this ever going to come to an end? You know, can you go over to this tent over here, which is set up as a coffee shop, just to get a change of scene, if you even want to call it that? I mean,
yeah, that was just bombed and destroyed, wasn't it, the other day? This gathering place, one of the few places left, and it got totally destroyed?
Well, there's been a bunch of places that have been destroyed like that, where a lot of civilians were hanging out. But Israel doesn't care. It's got an excuse every time. It was a Hamas operative. It was somebody with a human shield. It was a Hamas shelter. These are things they throw out ahead of time so that nobody will complain. These aren't Hamas strongholds. These are, you know, people forget that the Gazans, believe it or not, are actually human beings just like us. And if we were sitting, if our town, let's say, was under siege by an outside power and the fighters were coming and trying to get into our homes and schools, we would tell them to get the F out. Yeah. Well, the Gazans are no different. So all these stories about human shields, you've got to understand they're fabrications. There is no documented example to date of Hamas taking human shields. There are none. It is repeated over and over and over again in the Israeli propaganda about Hamas taking human shields. And the only documentation we have of an army using human shields is of the IDF using Palestinians as human shields. There are no documented cases by Amnesty, by Human Rights Watch, by B'Tselem of Palestinian fighters, of Hamas fighters, or whatever other groups they belong to, of them taking human shields. They're not doing it. Now, that's different from saying that, you know, if a Hamas soldier is off duty and he goes home to his family, should Israel have the right to bomb his house and kill everyone in it? That's how they're talking. Well, you know, he's off duty. He has a family. You know, he has a right to see his brothers and sisters and his mom and dad. But by Israeli standards, as soon as he walks into the house, he makes everyone in there a target. And so they blow it up, they kill him, they kill his siblings, they kill his parents, they often kill his grandparents, they destroy his home and all his belongings and all the family's belongings. Then they're forced out into the street. They have not enough money to be able to afford food. The water is not drinkable. It's in short supply. It's getting colder. It's rainy. I hope people get the picture. It is living hell.
And that's what Hudiya is saying in her letters, the ones where she's saying, does anyone still see us? And she's saying, you ask me how I feel. Look at the miles of rubble and debris. That's how I feel. You just can't take a picture of my soul. So they're definitely suffering. Now, part of the agreement of the ceasefire was some kind of a international force, monitors, independent monitors. Has any of that happening at all in compliance with that? Is anyone in there looking at what's going on?
It all sounded good. But, you know, if you look at the actual resolution that was passed in the Security Council, because Trump, of course, that was the only one the Americans would vote for. It's such a sham. It's you know, you want to cry over it. Because there were no particulars, there were no details in that resolution or in Trump's ceasefire plan that laid out how all this was going to take place. So this international stabilization force that is supposed to be going into Gaza to keep the peace, right now it's a big joke. The United States cannot find a single nation that is willing to commit troops from its nation and put them in the Gaza Strip. And of course, Netanyahu is thrilled by that because he's not happy about the idea of international anyone going into Gaza because he wants it. So, you know, it's a joke. I don't think it will ever happen personally. If it does, you know, maybe it's a positive step. But I think if people were to look really carefully at the ceasefire agreement and at anything else, including what's happening in the West Bank, what they're seeing, unfortunately, is the consolidation of Israeli territorial aggrandizement. And it's what I call the slow motion genocide, the slow motion expulsion of Palestinians, both from Gaza and from the West Bank. There was recently a scandal that Al Jazeera uncovered of Israeli airplanes. It was a different airplane, but the Israelis engineered this, where planes were coming to an airport in Israel and busloads of Palestinians from Gaza were getting on these planes and being flown to countries like South Africa. It's an expulsion. It was an expulsion exercise that Israel fronted somewhere in Germany. They had an office that it was called something else, but behind it ultimately was Israel.
And now Trump is talking about this establishing a peace council that he's going to, hey, he wants to head it. Of course, he wants to head everything.
He calls it the Board of Peace, which is perfectly well named because he's Board of Peace. And apparently all the people on his side are, too. I mean, they're not interested in peace. They're not interested at all. Netanyahu wants permanent war. Netanyahu is on his own holy crusade, pardon the metaphor, because what he wants is complete regional dominance. He wants Israel to dominate the Middle East. That's why he wants to go ahead and bomb Lebanon. That's why he wants to go ahead and bomb Iran again. And just because I think a lot of people don't, you know, understandably, not everyone follows this region of land that closely. But I want to explain to listeners that the reason Hezbollah and Iran are so frequently targeted, it's not because they're terrorists and trying to wipe Israel. No, the reason is because Iran and Hezbollah are the two fronts in the Middle East today, well, along with the Houthis, to be fair, that are resisting this encroachment of U.S.-Israeli dominance over the region. Hezbollah is armed. Iran is armed. So the United States and Israel want to get rid of them. They're the two out. They're the ones holding out. They're not giving in to the Americans. The current Lebanese government is ready to sell Lebanese sovereignty out the window. You know, the only thing holding Lebanon from that path is Hezbollah. And the same is true with Iran. We're not after Iran because of its nuclear weapons. It doesn't have any nuclear weapons. And we're not after it for, I don't know what other excuse Netanyahu is giving. We're after Iran because Iran is an independent nation with an independent foreign policy that opposes U.S.-Israeli regional dominance. And in its case, actually has a military power to back it up. That's why they're so threatened by Iran.
We don't have a lot of time left, kind of winding down here. Of course, so much to talk about. I do want to refer people to this statement by the Palestinian NGO network. Of course, the NGOs are being banned by Israel in operating in Gaza, but they have a statement of five demands to stop the genocide against the Palestinian people that's been signed by a large amount of international peace organizations that's worth looking at because none of their demands are outrageous by any means.
And no, in fact, that's what always puzzles me is that many people on the left are called radical for wanting the most moderate policies, equality under, you know, things that have been enshrined in international law for 80 years. I mean, so we got to ask what's really going on here.
And also refer people to, as we mentioned, the MadisonRafa.org has good links to a lot of different articles about Gaza, about the region, and of course, Counterpunch, we mentioned, Common Dreams. There's other places. We're hearing more crackdowns on people that have opinions that are not what the government wants to be publicized right now. I don't know if you've experienced that personally, but maybe you can give some final thoughts to people about what we can do.
Well, you know, I will repeat the words of the former journalist Robert Fisk, who passed away in 2020. Because literally 1999, what was that? 26 years ago. I'm terrible in math. In 1999, I went to Beirut for the first time. And I looked up Robert Fisk because I and some other people had invited him to the University of Wisconsin prior to that. And so I was in Beirut. He told me he would take me on a tour of, say, South Lebanon. I could go reporting with them, blah, blah, blah. And at the end of the day, I was feeling just, what the heck can I do? And he said, there's not really that much you can do. But what you can do, what really does make a difference is that you don't give up. Each one of us, he said, it's like you have a rock hammer and you're chipping away at a huge stone wall. And it feels pointless and like you're getting nowhere. But he says, if enough people chip away at that wall for a long enough time, eventually it's going to develop cracks. And eventually that wall is going to fall. So if you are a writer, if you are a speaker, if you are a radio announcer, if you locally recruit, if you organize demonstrations or educational evenings, keep doing it. Because in 25 years ago, the vast majority of young Americans didn't care anything about Palestine. And look where we are today. So there is change and there is hope, but only if we don't give up.
Well, thanks so much, Jennifer Lowenstein. I really appreciate you making the time in the middle of this holiday season to bring this perspective. Let's hope there's some more positive things happening. Maybe there's some trends in 2026 that we can hope for some movement in a positive direction for us. I know you wish that as well, and goodwill, as we say, to everyone. Thanks to Dennis for being here in engineering. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. This has been Global Stuff. Hope everyone enjoys the rest of the holiday season and be good to each other. Be kind to each other.
It's not difficult. Thank you very much.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.